Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast. So if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach and love and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Will you call me child when I tell you lies? 'Cause all I know is how to cry. Cause I am a sinner. If it's not one thing, it's another. Caught up in words, tangled in lies. But you are a savior, and you take brokenness aside and make it beautiful, beautiful.
Our reading this morning comes from the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verses 1 through 10. Very truly I tell you, anyone who does not enter the sheepfold by the gate, but climbs in by another way, is a thief and a bandit. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. They will not follow a stranger, but they will run from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. Jesus used this figure of speech with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So again, Jesus said to them, "Very truly, I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and bandits, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly."
I will be yours, oh. I will be yours for all my life, so let your mercy.
Jesus says, "I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. This feels to me like one of the clearest expressions of the mission and ministry of Jesus in all of the Gospels. I came that you would have life and have it abundantly. We open worship with a song from All Sons and Daughters that I think beautifully expresses this movement. If it's not one thing, it's another. I'm caught up in words, tangled in lies, but you, God, are a Savior, and you take brokenness aside and make it beautiful, beautiful. That's abundant life. That's the beauty of God's love meeting us in our failures and in our brokenness and rising strong within us and around us and then leading us to abundant life. And to be clear, dominant voices in Christianity today would often have us try to collapse salvation into merely being an erasure of sin, an erasure of brokenness. But thankfully, the Gospel of John and Jesus seem to push beyond that and say that this isn't merely about being freed from something, it's also being freed to life, life abundantly. And it's important for me to understand that this reading comes to us in the context of the Gospel of John. And just before this, we encounter Jesus meeting a man born blind and healing him. And abundant life for the man born blind is fairly obvious. It's sight. It's being able to see what is right before us. That's perhaps what salvation is for him. And it leads me to wonder, like, what does that look like in each of our individual lives? So I was thinking this week about the homeless teen moms working with Tubman House, and that $17,000 came in on the big day of giving to help these young girls have both a shelter over their head and hope for how God might be calling them. It feels to me like that's what abundant life might look like, what salvation might be. I was thinking also this week about teenagers in our community who the way that they express their gender identity doesn't fit with the dominant norms around them. And so they can find themselves in places of bullying or having to deal with questions that no one should ever have to deal with. And wondering about maybe abundant life is when an adult, a teacher, a person from our community of faith, a parent, a neighbor, comes alongside them and accompanies them just to remind them they're a beloved child of God and there's nothing they can do about it. Or for folks who are thinking about retirement or have recently retired, I wonder if abundant life might look like finding yourself meeting for the very first time a family of five from Afghanistan and breaking bread together. Abundant life looks different in different places and for different people. But whatever the differences might be, we all experience some version of thieves and bandits that would try to steal that abundant life from us. And I think that's at the heart of what Jesus is trying to name in this little story. Jesus meets us in the midst of those places and emboldens us to rise strong into whatever abundant life looks like in your location. So throughout this season of Easter, we're gathering together to hold the readings that are assigned to the global church in dialogue and conversation with the writings of Brené Brown, specifically her most recent book called Rising Strong. She says, "You may not have signed up for a hero's journey, but the second you fell down, got your butt kicked, suffered a disappointment, screwed up, or felt your heart break, it started. It doesn't matter whether we are ready for an emotional adventure. Hurt just happens. And it happens to every single one of us without exception. The only decision," she says, "that we have to make is, do we want to write the story or do we want to hand that power over to someone else? So choosing to write our own stories means we're going to need to get uncomfortable and we're going to have to choose courage over comfort." It's that moment when we find ourselves, as Linda shared about in our first week, in that face down in the arena moment, having totally disappointed ourselves or the world, we have an opportunity to start to reckon with the emotions that come up for us, with our own failure, our own disappointment. And the disciples knew this perhaps better than anyone. as they looked on at the one in whom they had placed their hope and watched and witnessed his death. That felt to them like the deepest sense of failure. And this season of Easter lasts for 50 days. And I'm convinced that that's not a coincidence, because it seems that we need at least that long to try to integrate what's actually happening in our lives and in the midst of the brokenness, to start to reckon with some of the feelings, to start to rumble with the competing stories that come to us, and then to finally move into this place of revelation to see how God might be calling us. And the church takes not one day of Easter, but 50 days to give us space to live into what resurrection means to us. Brené Brown just kind of categorizes it in this simple movement. She says, we fall, we learn, we get up, and we do it again. That's the rising strong process. And the disciples were in the midst of this process as they tried to make sense of Jesus' death and of the earth-shattering news of his new life. And it's noteworthy to me that instead of staying in the moment of after Jesus' death and resurrection, the reading that's assigned to the church for this Sunday and Easter globally goes back into Jesus' ministry. It's as though we need to revisit what he was up to on earth to try to figure out what it means on this side of the resurrection experience. In order to reckon with the depths of the story in our lives, we're going to have to reckon with what Jesus was up to before his life was taken. We need to spend some time looking back on how we got to this place. I love to do this, actually. This is the place where I feel probably most at home in myself, is in a community space like this, thinking about, you hear it every time Linda and I share this story. We're a church that started at 7th and J. We want to look back on our story to try to see, where are we heading? I love that process. It helps me align my life with those who've gone before me, with the hopes that I have for myself, and then the dream that I think God holds for us. And I can get really excited about doing that. Like when we imagine rooting our lives in grace and worship, or creating simple structures for people to watch over each other in love. We call those kitchen tables. Like, it feels to me like this is what God needs us to do as we rise strong, is to gather together each week to root our lives in grace, and then to come together in small, intimate groups to share about the brokenness we experience, and then find creative ways to live life abundantly by reaching in love. The trouble for me is I like that process up here. I love to think about that process. And abundant life isn't just found in the imagination of my head or yours. It's found in the midst of the messiness of the real relationships, the hurt that we experience with our neighbors, and the hope that we experience as they hold us up. Abundant life unfolds as we fall, as we learn, as we get up, and as we do it again, and it requires what Brené Brown calls an emotional reckoning. So, it's not lost on me that this moment in the series, when we move into how are we going to grapple with our emotions, how are we going to really turn and face the feelings that we have? Linda takes off to Portland. And let's just say she's the more emotionally charged of the two of us. And it is somewhat ironic and maybe really grace-filled that I'm the pastor that's tasked with trying to work on this with you guys today. At least that's my hope. Brené Brown says that this reckoning with our emotions as we experience failure or disappointment, it has two deceptively simple parts. And they're more deceptive to me than they are simple. I want to confess that. The first is engaging with our feelings. And then the second is getting curious about the story behind the feelings. What emotions we're experiencing and how are they connected to our thoughts and our behaviors? And it's not earth-shattering for me to acknowledge that engaging those feelings isn't the easiest for me. And they say that preachers, really anybody that's preaching, all they're ever doing is sharing the news that they need to hear themselves. And that's probably as true in this moment as it's ever been for me. And I know I'm not alone I'm not alone in this process of struggling with trying to figure out how do I integrate my feelings and how do I actually get curious about them. Research shows us that most of us have been taught to not pay attention to our emotions. And I don't have to, we have half the room is therapists and social workers, so this is not news to many people in the room. But we struggle as a people with trying to figure out what do we do with our emotions. Because we see emotions as a sign of vulnerability, and then we equate vulnerability with weakness. And we say, I'm not going to ask or tell people about my emotions, because there's really nothing that could be gained from sharing about it. It's just how I feel. We have a lot of these ways to try to avoid our feelings. A lot of it is, I think, that we don't actually have the language to access our emotions. And sometimes we're taught that discussing emotions is frivolous, or even worse, it's self-indulgent. And some of us become so numb to feelings that there's simply nothing there to discuss. And for a lot of us, the uncertainty of the feelings is simply too uncomfortable. And we worry that it's going to invite us into questions that we don't have the answers to, and that unknown is a fearful place to go. So I want to try to invite us to go into that. And Brené Brown does it by sharing about this pivotal moment in The Empire Strikes Back. Okay? She's wanting to help us think about, like, what does abundant life look like? And in order to find abundant life, we're going to have to go through the gate into our feelings and into our emotions. We're going to have to reckon with them, with our own fear and anger, our aggression, our shame, our blame. And this is not easy. Denying our stories and disengaging emotions, that allows the thieves and the bandits to take us away. That's the way Jesus talked about it. So what we're going to see here is Yoda training Luke to be a Jedi, okay? We haven't used Star Wars before in worship, but I'm kind of excited about this. So in this moment, what's happening is the scene that we're going to miss is Luke is running through this, like, terrible jungle thing, and Yoda's on his back, and he gets down, and Luke is going to feel something cold and dark. And what we're going to see is Yoda invite him into the depths of that experience. So let's watch. Luke goes deep into that cave, and Yoda tells him, like, you don't need your weapons, but we all take them. When we go into those emotionally hard places, we go into the depths of our own disappointment, and I bring with me mostly lists. I bring lists of all the ways that I'm, like, good enough and okay, and that I have done it. And that's a weapon that I take. And Yoda says, your weapons you will not need. Brené Brown says it this way: walking into our stories of hurt is like walking into the cave in Yoda's swamp. It can feel dangerous and foreboding, and what we must ultimately confront is ourself. The most difficult part of our stories is often that we bring to them what we make up about who we are and how we are perceived by others. Yes, maybe we lost our job or we screwed up a project, but what makes the story so painful is that we tell ourselves about our own self-worth and value, about what we tell ourselves about our own self-worth and value. In order to move through the gate toward abundant life, we're going to need to spend time in this cave of reckoning. And we learn lots of ways to avoid the cave. We learn lots of ways to stay out there with Yoda rather than going into that space. And Brené Brown lifts up some of them, and I'm going to add to her list because I've got even more. One she calls chandeliering. So this is when we pack hurt down in our lives, at least we think we do, and then someone unintentionally and completely unaware asks us a question or mentions something that touches the tenderness of that place, and we're so upset that we can reach to the chandelier when we jump. That's one of the ways that we avoid our feelings. We pack it down. I'm way better at bouncing hurt That's what I like to do. I am really, really good at bouncing hurt. This comes up for me when I'm going to have a meeting with our district superintendent, and that's in the United Methodist world. That's the pastor that oversees the churches in this area. And I never know, like, one, if the meeting's really going to happen, and then two, what might come up when it does and what kind of structure it's going to take. And so I come in with, like, 6 pages of lists of things so I can, like, bounce. Because what I'm afraid of is actually sitting in the discomfort with that person. So I come in ready to bounce all of those things off of my supervisor. One of the ways we bounce is we compare, or we prove, or we try to perfect something, or we compete. Sometimes we numb the hurt. And we all have our ways of doing this, whether it's another drink, or whether it's going back to the gym one more time, or whether it's more food. We all have ways where we numb ourselves from the vulnerability. And the problem with this process is that as soon as we numb ourselves from the hurts, then we also aren't as open to the highs. And so we tend to live in this place that just keeps declining. And it's this vicious cycle. It's this vicious cycle of becoming ever more dull to love and to trust. Some of us stockpile hurt. We amass so much hurt in ourselves that our body, like, physically actually shuts down. And there are all kinds of reasons and chemical things and that I'm not going to move into in terms of why depression happens and how that emerges, and I don't claim to be an expert in this. But also, one of the things that happens is we take on so much of the hurt and push it so deep down that our body just gives up. It, like, cannot hang in there with us. So we continue to stockpile these things. These are some of the ways that we offload this. Some of us she has this phenomenal example that she calls, we fear and we have hurt around being high-centered. I never knew what this was, but she's in a car and she's driving it, and somehow she goes over a median, and then her car ends up on top of the median, but the wheels are all this high. So you can imagine how not fun that would be to have your car what they call high-centered, so the wheels aren't there. And what she says is that we have so much fear about getting into a place of being stuck that we don't actually allow ourselves to go into our feelings or our emotions. One of my favorites is, she calls the Umbridge, Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter. This is a person who wears the, like, pink suit and the hat, and she just seems so great, but on the side, she, like, tortures small children. Right? So some of us are like, how are things? Things are great. Things are awesome. How could you not be awesome? It's so good. But underneath, that person who presents as everything is so great is a wreck, a train wreck. And we all have various ways that we offload our fears and avoid our feelings about our own disappointments. And then we become the thief. We become the person who robs us from life abundant. We become the one who goes, instead of through the gate, around the side. And Jesus says, I am the gate, and we are all invited to go in. And so the opposite of offloading our fears and our hopes is integrating them. The gate of Jesus, which leads to abundant life, demands that we integrate our experiences and our emotions through this long and courageous process of reckoning with our own feelings en route to rising strong. Jesus says, the gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. This chapter in John challenges us to witness the risen one as both the gate to abundant life and also the shepherd that invites us and speaks us toward abundant life. And once again, Jesus interrupts and disrupts this notion of an either or. Well, are you the gate or are you the shepherd? That's a pretty obvious question if we're going to try to read this literally. Like, first of all, how is Jesus going to be a gate? That doesn't make any sense. But our story, our Christian tradition, is rooted in paradox. And so in this very movement, we find it once again where Jesus is both gate and shepherd, calling us into the depths of life together, which he calls abundant life. And so here are a couple of the ways that we might start to move into that abundant life. And I'm going to use two from Brené Brown and one that Linda and I have worked on. And the first one, she calls permission slips. And she tells about this story when she's going to meet Oprah for the first time. You can imagine the anxiety that you would have if you were going to go meet Oprah. So she gave herself a permission slip, and she physically writes it down. And her permission slip was, it's okay to be goofy and to be in awe, right? Sometimes we actually need to write that note to ourselves and put it down because our fear is going to come up and we're not going to allow ourselves to really be present in that moment. So she encourages us to write permission slips about how we're going to engage our feelings. It's going to be okay if you're goofy today. That might sound like completely not scary to you. I would never write that down. Like, I would never write that down. And maybe I need to work on that. The second is, I have this image. She says, I said it to a person today who I know is in a really, really hard place. This person has to face a really hard thing with someone he loves this afternoon. And I found myself saying to this person, breathe. And you know, when that person tells you to breathe, like, you want to punch them in the nose. Like, that is not the helpful thing at that particular moment, at least for some of us at that moment. And Brené writes about how I have this image in Berkeley of all the mindfulness workshops around breathing so that we can all those things. But she also interviews a number of Green Berets, and they have what they call tactical breathing. So people from Berkeley to the military have recognized that our patterns of breathing can actually help us move into our feelings and then toward abundant life. Like, they can be a gate. And she gives this beautiful image of what is called the square or box breathing. And so we inhale through our nose for 4 seconds. And then we hold that for 4 seconds. And then we exhale for 4 seconds. And then we hold that for 4 seconds. And it's this rhythm that we can move ourselves into, and we can actually start to breathe into feeling who we are and how we are. I don't know about you, but for me, the kitchen table is the place where I really am invited every week into my own reckoning with how I'm doing. And we do that as we gather in the fireside room every Wednesday. And it is this opportunity to notice and to be curious about the hurts that I hold in my life and the disappointments. Brené Brown writes, "One of the truisms of wholehearted living is that you either walk into your story on your own, in your own truth, or you live outside of your story and you start to hustle for your own worthiness." And Jesus says, "I came that you may have life, and have it abundantly." So what emotional reckoning might be the gate in your life right now that could lead you into abundant life? Instead of covering our brokenness, could we see that the risen one meets us in brokenness and claims that as beautiful? Our brokenness is part of who we are. We fall, we learn, and we reckon, we rumble, and we integrate, and we rise strong. This is the movement of resurrection. It's not a long-ago proof of God's power that happened at one moment. The rising strong, resurrection, is something that happens over and over and over and over and over. It's the way of Jesus, and it's a way that leads to abundant life. And Jesus says, in you must go through this gate, into the depths of your own feelings. So will we allow ourselves to notice the voice of the Good Shepherd that calls us to abundant life? One of the people whose voices takes me into the feeling of who I am and how I am is a singer-songwriter who passed away, Leonard Cohen. And he has a song called Anthem. And he was interviewed talking about the song, and he says this about it: "If you have to come up with a philosophical ground for this whole album that he produced back in 92, he says, that is, ring the bells that still can ring. It's no excuse. The dismal situation in the future is no excuse for an abdication of your own personal responsibilities toward yourself and your job, your family, your neighbors, your love. Ring the bells that still can ring." They're few and far between, but you can find them. Forget your perfect offering, he says. That's the hang up, that you're going to work this thing out, because we confuse this idea and we've forgotten the central myth of our culture, which is the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. He says, this situation does not admit of solution or perfection. This is not the place where you make things perfect, neither your marriage, nor your work, nor anything, nor your love of God, nor your love of family or country. The thing is imperfect. And worse, there is a crack in everything. Everything that you can put together, physical objects, mental objects, constructions of any kind, but that's where the light gets in. That's where the light gets in. And that's where the resurrection is. And that's where the return, that's where the repentance is. It is with the confrontation, with the brokenness of things. And so may the God who rises strong open the gate for all of us, that we may reckon with the brokenness of our lives and see that this indeed is how we rise strong. There is a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in. Amen.
You can add up the parts. You won't have the sum. You can strike up the march. There is no drum. Every heart to love will come. But like a refugee, ring, 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 ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in.